Hello everyone, and welcome to the Cure Panel Talk Show. I'm
Priya Menon,
Scientific Media Editor at Cure Talk, and I welcome all of you this evening to a discussion on multiple myeloma. I would like to mention that I'm not keeping very well today, and I so might sound a bit hoarse. Sorry about that. This is the 26th episode of the Cure Panel Talk Show, and we're excited to announce that it has been exactly a year since we began the Cure Panel Talk Show series. It was on 22nd August 2012 that we started our show with a discussion on multiple myeloma with Dr. Ravi Vij, and we are privileged to have Dr. Vij once again with us today. Over the year, we have extended our Cure Panel Talk Show platform to include discussions on prostate cancer, yoga, health tech, mental health, and we are launching our talk series on breast cancer tomorrow at the same time with Dr. Julie Grallo of Seattle Cancer Alliance. In the coming weeks, we have two more shows for our myeloma community. Our live on-air support group meeting hosted by myeloma survivor Pat Killingsworth is scheduled for 28th August at 6 p.m. ET, and the topic of discussion is treatment extremes, comparing and contrasting different treatment options. We follow this up with a discussion on diet and myeloma on 2nd September at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, with none other than scientist and blogger Danny S. Parker. Please visit our website www.trialex.com/curetalk for information regarding our shows, and you can always mail me priya@trialex.com if you would like to register for the shows. Coming back to today's panel, we have with us Dr. Ravi Vij, Associate Professor of Medicine, Washington University School of Medicine, St. Louis. Dr. Vij serves in the section of Stem Cell Transplant and Leukemia, Division of Oncology. Dr. Vij's research focus is the treatment of hematologic malignancies and hematopoietic stem cell transplantation. Welcome to the show, Dr. Vij. It's a pleasure to have you with us again. We also have a special guest with us today, Annie Quinn Young of MMRF. Annie would be providing us with an outline of MMRF activities. On the panel, we have myeloma survivor and editor of MyelomaSurvival.com, Gary Peterson, who's also co-hosting the show with me today, myeloma author and survivor Pat Killingsworth, myeloma survivor and advocate Jack Aiello, and myeloma survivor and humorist Nick Van Dyke. I welcome each and every one of you to the Cure Panel Talk Show on myeloma. We will be taking questions at the end of the discussion. And if you have a question for our panel, you may press a 1 on your keypad, and we will bring you live on air to ask your questions. Gary would now introduce us to the topic of today's discussion. Gary, you're on air. Gary, can you hear me? I think Gary has not been able to call us up. Dr. Vij, welcome to the show, Dr. Vij. I invite you to talk on today's topic of discussion, allogenic transplants, pros and cons. Dr. Vij, you're on air.
Okay. Well, thank you for the invitation. So I think that we have chosen a topic that certainly is still very relevant in today's day and age. Allogeneic transplantation, which means getting your stem cells not only from your own self, but rather from a donor, either a sibling donor or an unrelated donor, has been under investigation for well over 2 to 3 decades. It hasn't become mainstream and still is mainly in the realm of clinical trials. It is area which now, as far as stem cell sources go, has expanded allogeneic transplantation itself into alternative donor transplantation, including cord and blood transplantation transplantation from haploidentical donors. So certainly in the field of allogeneic transplantation, overall, there has been major progress. Also, over the last decade and a half, the use of reduced intensity transplantation, where we rely more on the donor's immune system to attack the cancer in the host, has taken off in a big way and has brought down the morbidity and mortality of stem cell transplantation substantially, and has been a technology that is now applicable to even older individuals well into their late 60s and early 70s in age. But despite the advances that we've made in stem cell transplantation overall, in multiple myeloma, it is more the exception rather than the rule. This is on account of contradictory results from clinical trials that have been done. As I said, allogeneic transplantation has been something that has been offered to patients on trials for well over two decades. And the initial experience with allogeneic stem cell transplantation involved what we call fully myeloablative transplants, wherein one relied on the chemotherapy and radiation administered to the patient prior to the transplant to eradicate the disease quickly, and then the stem cell source was mainly to provide fresh bone marrow to allow for blood cell production. That experience with long-term follow-up showed that there was about a 10 to 20%, depending on the series that you look at, 15-year plus disease-free survival, suggesting that those patients perhaps are cured of their disease. The issue had been at that time the high upfront mortality rate from that kind of procedure, which was in the vicinity of 30 to 50% out at 6 months post-transplant. So it was felt based on multiple trials done at that time that though the procedure carried curative potential, it unfortunately harmed more people than it perhaps helped, because though the patients that succumbed to the complications of stem cell transplantation may not have otherwise been cured, they could have had long-term disease control and sometimes very extended periods of disease control with either conventional therapy or with autologous stem cell transplantation. Now, what contributed to this excess mortality in patients with myeloma specifically is still unclear. Allogeneic transplantation does carry high risks irrespective of disease being transplanted. But for some reason, the numbers succumbing to complications in myeloma was far higher than that what had been observed in other disease states. This has been attributed by different people to possibly the subclinical organ impairment that may occur in patients with multiple myeloma. We know that patients with myeloma often have kidney problems, and it is possible that their ability to tolerate the drugs at higher doses may be compromised by other organ involvement. Often, patients with myeloma are having a performance status that is more compromised, and being an older population often than is transplanted for other diseases, other comorbidities perhaps put patients at a higher risk of complications of allogeneic transplantation. So at that time, actually, a randomized trial that was looking at autologous transplant versus allogeneic transplant was actually terminated early because it was thought unethical to even conduct the trial because of the high mortality rate that ensued with allogeneic transplantation. More recently, as I said, over the last 10 to 15 years, we've certainly started doing these reduced intensity transplants, which have really brought down the upfront toxicity of transplantation. So instead of 30 to 50% treatment-related mortality figures. We are now perhaps down to 10% or less at the 6-month point, and perhaps no more than 10 to 15% mortality figures at the 1-year point. The issue is that reduced intensity transplant, as I said, relies more on the donor's graft to provide the anti-myeloma activity. The immune cells in the donor graft attack the cancer in the recipient. It relies less on the chemotherapy and radiation aspect that we deliver to patients at the outset. So by reducing the intensity of the chemotherapy and the radiation therapy given at the outset, we've been able to reduce the toxicity of the procedure. The issue therein is that the graft versus tumor response, as we call it, the immune effects of the donor graft, are more slow in developing. They take often weeks to months to fully exert their benefit. So in a disease state, if we have patients who are progressing at the time of transplant or have very active disease at the time of transplant, it will often require more rapid disease control than what reduced intensity transplant can offer. So even today, a lot of patients do undergo fully myeloablative transplants, especially if their disease burden is high at the time of allogeneic transplantation. However, one other strategy that has evolved is to do what we call tandem autologous allogeneic transplantation. So therein, you do an autologous transplant like you traditionally do with high-dose chemotherapy, and then 3 to 6 months later, most of these patients undergoing this kind of procedure have a sibling donor. These patients undergo an allogeneic transplant from a sibling donor. Certainly, unrelated donor transplants have also been performed as the second transplant. So what that brings is more rapid disease control by the autologous transplant, and then potentially a curative aspect with the allogeneic transplant procedure. Now, with that, we have seen that we are able to successfully accomplish these transplants with, again, low morbidity and mortality. But we haven't been able to conclusively show that this is better than just doing either a single or a tandem autologous transplant alone. There have been numerous studies in this regard, perhaps half a dozen large randomized trials, and two of these trials did come up with positive results, suggesting that patients who undergo a tandem autologous allogeneic transplant approach do seem to have better long-term overall survival, and possibly some patients are, again, being cured of their disease. The problem is that for most studies, the follow-up is short, and for most, four out of the six odd studies, so far, there has no survival advantage that has emerged with the use of autologous followed by allogeneic transplantation compared to tandem autologous transplantation alone. Now, the critics who favor allogeneic transplants say the four studies that are so far not positive have shorter follow-up, and it is possible that with longer-term follow-up, a survival advantage may emerge. This may well be the case. Because with longer follow-up, it is often seen that the survival advantage that is lacking early on suddenly starts kind of becoming more apparent. So we do, I think, need more longer-term follow-up with the allogeneic transplant studies that have been conducted in the era of reduced intensity transplantation. But to also say, we have to see what other options we have for patients. And there we've seen a plethora of options that have emerged over the last 10-plus years. And autologous transplant, though not usually offered as a curative therapy, is meant to be a life-extending therapy. However, the data from now two large groups of patients, one here in the United States and one in Europe, with long-term follow-up suggests that 30% of patients that attain a complete remission after autologous transplant are alive and disease-free 12-plus years out from transplant. Well, now we are having more and more patients enter complete remission. So rates of complete remission after autologous transplant are achieved in about 50 to 60% of patients instead of the 30%. So if we say that a third of the 50 to 60% of patients are going to be alive and disease-free potentially 10 to 12 years out, we're going to have a lot more people living long-term with just autologous transplant, which is much safer a procedure, carries usually in the best of hands 1 to 2% mortality rate. And so I think that we are making progress with our newer drugs being incorporated into the transplant paradigm, which are going to potentially allow more people to be alive and disease-free even after autologous transplant 10, 12, 15 years out. Now, again, are these patients potentially cured? We hope that some, if not all, are, especially if they've gone that far out without progression. However, patients need to realize that still not too many transplanters are going to talk about autologous transplant as a potentially curative therapy. The other thing is that, as I said, our armamentarium of drugs is expanding, and even for patients who are not transplant candidates, we are having better results. As we have seen, we've had two new drugs approved within the last year for multiple myeloma, carfilzomib and pomalidomide, added to bortezomib, revlimid, and thalidomide that came in the first decade of this millennium, we certainly have made major strides. And then there are at least a few antibodies now in development that seem to be very promising, including elotuzumab, daratumumab, and other CD38 antigen, which is an antigen present on myeloma cells, directed antibodies that some people feel that the best is yet to come from conventional therapy. So people are often conflicted about whether we should be subjecting patients to a high-risk procedure for potentially curative impact rather than just going with our increasingly more effective field of chemotherapy drugs. So I think that allogeneic transplant, for most part, remains the realm of investigation. There are moves afoot to still do large allogeneic transplant studies. The two groups of patients where this is felt to be worth exploring further with new trials is patients who have high-risk chromosomal features, wherein perhaps using it as an upfront strategy is appropriate, or patients who have got early relapses after their initial treatment, be it transplant or non-transplant treatments, those patients too are likely to have a shorter survival. So there too, the use of allogeneic transplant is proposed to be looked at in the high-risk group of patients. So I think that allogeneic transplantation still is going to be an area of active research. It may, in the years to come, provide data that is going to be a procedure that may become applicable for more patients. Right now, I think that still caution is advised. We do have different approaches to allogeneic transplantation among different physicians at different centers. Often asked is, would you do it in a patient that is very young? And certainly, we, I think, all in such patients have a discussion. We often see patients in their 20s with myeloma. It's not a common occurrence, but happens. And so, especially in that patient population, I think a lot of physicians, especially transplanters, are willing to explore allogeneic transplant outside of the context of a clinical trial. But I think different physicians have different comfort levels in suggesting allogeneic transplantation off clinical trial. So I think I've had a long monologue on this issue, and I think at this point I will probably give it back to the moderator so that one can probably come to the more interesting question and answer aspect of the session.
Dr. Vige, this is Gary Peterson. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, good. Sorry, it was a little bit of a technology snafu, and I got on a little bit late to introduce you, but what we'll do is we'll go from here. And unfortunately, I had this great introduction for you that made you, you know, sound like a prince of myeloma. But for now, what I'll have to do is to limit that to the transition that we'll make a little bit later. And what I mean by that is that in 2011, the MMRC, which is the Multiple Myeloma Research Consortium, made you their center of the year. And what that is that the MRC is one of the two best myeloma organizations in the world, and I've already raised $190 million for myeloma research. And they've awarded Dr. Vige this because he's been instrumental in pushing the envelope of myeloma research with many of the various clinical trials that have come and pushed forward the whole frontier of myeloma research. So for that, not only do we thank you, but we thank the excellent efforts of the MMRC. And their efforts and yours will continue to save life. So a little bit later, we'll be talking to Ann Quinn. But now I'd like to go forward with the questions with respect to the pros and cons of the allo. My first question for you, Doctor, is with respect to the allogeneic transplant. I understand that only 1 second. That historically, I understand that the first year mortality is about 30 to 50%, or not so good. And you might have talked about this, but what, if anything, has changed to improve on this mortality? You know, if you look at the, I think it's the CIBMTR, a group of 500 transplant hospitals, which I think you are part of, that their graph shows for the donor transplant a 50% mortality rate, and for the match sibling transplant, 30%. So could you comment on that?
Yeah, I think that a lot of those figures are from patients that were transplanted in the 90s and early part of this millennium when, as I said, fully ablative allogeneic transplantations were employed. More recently, with the use of reduced intensity transplants or tandem autologous reduced intensity transplants, the 1 year mortality figure, inclusive of disease relapse, is perhaps no more than 20%. And treatment related mortality, which we attribute actually to the transplant per se, is a much more manageable 10 to 15% in most series. So I think that we've kind of brought that figure down substantially. But also to keep in mind with allogeneic transplant, it is not only the mortality figure that we need to concentrate on. We also need to be cognizant of the fact that it has major issues regarding quality of life. So even in young individuals, half the people who are cured of their disease never return to productive employment. And a lot of patients, unfortunately, have bad sequelae of an entity called chronic graft-versus-host disease. They have sequelae of long-term steroid use, requiring large doses of steroids on a daily basis for sometimes months at a time. So we need to factor all that in. Though the mortality has come down, the morbidity can still be substantial.
Okay. Thank you. Now, are you a member? I'm not sure. I didn't look. CIBMTR? I think you are.
So the CIBMTR is the bone marrow transplant registry, which gathers data from all its members, all centers that are willing to submit data to it. And we are actually one of the larger centers in the CIBMTR umbrella. We kind of submit data to them, and certainly, yes, we are.
Oh, okay. Well, their information was between 2009, and it showed that the that on that graph it showed that 38% survival for sibling donor versus 48% for the auto transplant, and this was went out to 6 years. And at that point, the allo curve had flattened, meaning that it looked like no more people were dying, and while the auto still was declining at 6 years. Do you know when they intersect or if they intersect? And does this mean that the 38% of the allo patients are cured? Of course, sans the graft versus host issue that you mentioned.
Sure. So those curves need to be looked at with some precision. First of all, this is not randomized data between allogeneic transplant and allogeneic and autologous transplantation. These are individual groups of patients in their registry, and they look at the outcomes of patients and then just plot it on a single curve. So that can give rise to a lot of false kind of assumptions. But having said that, I think that 38% cure rate probably is not achievable with allogeneic transplantation. The six-year progression-free survival of 38% does not translate into a cure. I think for potentially saying that some of these patients are cured, you have to look at least figures beyond 10 years. Some people would say 15 plus years. And I realize you're saying that the curve seems to be flattening out. However, the thing is that there are, unfortunately, late relapses. And if you look at the autologous transplant figures from the present era, wherein we are giving autologous transplant followed by maintenance Revlimid, the latest data from the CLGB study suggests progression-free survival approaching 4 years. So that says that about 50% of transplant patients who undergo autologous transplant have not even progressed at 4 years. And even after they progress, they have years and years of healthy life with multiple treatment options. And I think that some people are talking about, you know, median survivals incorporating autologous transplant and newer therapies extending in the vicinity of 10 years soon, and perhaps sooner even thereafter, surpassing 10 plus years. So I think that we need to keep that in perspective.
Okay, well, that sounds very encouraging. Thank you so much. Pat Killingsworth, are you on the line? Pat?
Hello, doctor. I have so many questions, but of course I'll limit them. Just to start, what is a depleted allo?
Depleted allo?
Yes.
So I think that you may be referring to one or two possible scenarios. So the depleted allo you're probably referring to is where we do this T-cell depletion. So that is, you take the immune cells out of the initial graft that you get from patients. And that is meant to reduce the graft versus host disease. But a downside of reducing graft versus host disease by depleting the T cells from the allogeneic graft is you also deplete the graft or the graft versus tumor effect to a great extent, and thereby increase the risk of disease relapse. So T cell depletion continues to be studied in clinical trials and even in myeloma. And what they do is after some time, they give those T cells back later in the course to try to, reduce the GVHD, graft versus host disease up front, but then somehow produce the graft versus tumor effect later in the course of the disease. The other place where the word depletion is used is more in the context of an autologous transplant, where you are talking about depleting the graft of potentially contaminating tumor cells, and that, at least in a large study done more than a decade and a half ago, did not seem to result in any better outcomes. That study, has been something that has not been repeated with our modern technologies of trying to purge tumor cells, but at least at that time, did not seem to be a successful strategy.
Sure, thank you. I have a reader named Mark who underwent depleted aloe, and he's doing very well and has a high quality of life and is quite an advocate. So, some of this is coming from on his behalf. Timing. Why could you explain why aloes tend to work better early? And that said, it's anecdotal, but I know several. I have several friends in the myeloma community that have had salvage therapy, aloes, last ditch aloes that supposedly don't work, and they're both alive and improving after 1 year. Very anecdotal evidence to patients, but for a strategy that supposedly doesn't work. I'm two for two. I see two friends, and they both did well. Could you explain why timing is important and just talk about salvage aloes just a little bit?
Sure. So I'm very glad that about your friend and friends who are doing well. I think that, again, different individuals have different outcomes, and it is a little bit risky to give anecdotes advocate one thing versus the other, because unfortunately those that don't do well often don't get quoted as often as those
yes,
that
not around,
have better outcomes.
Sure.
But all the same, I think that very true. The reduced intensity transplants with add back of T cells is a very viable strategy that should and continues to be explored. As to your question about why allogeneic transplant works best at the beginning rather than later in the course of the disease, I think that has to pretty much do with the disease biology. Not only transplant, drugs do work better early in the course of the disease when the cells are more sensitive to chemotherapy drugs and to graft versus tumor response. As the tumor evolves over the years, different kinds of what we call clones of these cells are now known to emerge that acquire resistance and because of their genetic makeup don't respond as well to any kind of intervention. So the allogeneic transplant done late faces the same kind of hurdles that any kind of treatment faces.
Oh, that makes perfect sense. Thank you. That helps a lot. Now, how about I understand that the results of, say, after a first or even a second relapse, that the studies are showing similar success rates. Can the same be said for autos? Can the same be said for allos?
So, I think that what you're first saying is that autologous transplants done as salvage after progression from an initial autologous transplant has been a successful strategy for some patients, and I totally agree. I think that usually, at least in the era before maintenance became widely practiced, a second autologous transplant offered about half the progression-free survival that the first would. So most centers advocated doing it in patients that have had at least 2 years treatment-free after the first transplant. If your question, the second part of your question, not sure I get, but I think you're asking about the possibility of doing a second allogeneic transplant procedure after progression from the first.
I'm sorry, and, doctor. I meant the data coming out now. If you were going to, for your first autologous transplant, shows that after first or even second relapse, the success rate is the same, as opposed to doing one early, right?
Sure.
After
you're talking about early versus late autologous transplant?
Right. So I just wondered if the same can be said for an allo.
So again, for the autologous transplant, the data that you're quoting is from a French study that was done that showed that autologous transplant done within the first few months of diagnosis versus at first relapse offers the same benefit in terms of years of life gained. That study, however, did favor upfront autologous transplantation for reasons of better quality of life, better time of disease control, and less time spent overall on treatment during a patient's lifespan. So, there is a study that is currently ongoing called the IFM Dana-Farber study that is trying to see if the same paradigm holds true in the era of modern drugs. My own gut feeling is that it probably will hold true, that delaying transplant till first progression will probably be fine in terms of your endpoint being longevity. However, you have to factor in that patients who get a transplant later in the course of the disease have a shorter time of disease control usually. With the use of upfront transplant, as I said, the CLGB study that showed that maintenance Revlimid is beneficial for patients has the best data of any approach to date, wherein patients who got an autologous transplant and Revlimid maintenance are now approaching 4 years progression-free. That kind of period without needing to deal with sequelae of the drugs or the disease is probably not going to be attained if you were to delay the transplant later.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you, Pat. Now on to Jack Aiello. Jack is happens to be a long-term survivor, 20 years, and has had most recently an allo. So he's got some great questions. Jack, are you online?
I am.
All right.
Hello.
You're on. You can ask your question.
Sorry, I had to unmute myself. Dr. Vige, yeah, that allo I had was after two TAN Amato failed. So that allo I had was back in 98. And one question I have is back then we talked about if I got a remission and I then relapsed, we talked about doing a DLI, a donor leukocyte infusion. But that was before all these new drugs, novel therapy drugs, came around. So if you have a patient today who's had a 15-year remission from a full allo, would a DLI or would other treatment be used first?
So hopefully a person who's gone 15 years will never, ever have to deal with that scenario at all. But in the unlikely event that that was ever to occur, it partly depends on how aggressive the relapse is, what we call donor chimerism analysis shows, whether the graft analysis, which can be done in laboratories, shows that predominance of donor cells are still present, or that you have more of the recipient's own bone marrow starting to emerge. And often it's not an either-or proposition. In diseases where a lot of donor lymphocyte infusions are given, actually you initially give drugs to control the disease and then actually follow it up with a DLI to consolidate the gains, because the DLI, as I explained to you before, does take some time to exert its effect. And especially if your disease is starting to progress, you want to have something have more immediate effectiveness, and that drugs will probably do better than a DLI in the short term. So in most cases, it would be both in sequence.
Got it. And then the second question, I think you've kind of answered. I still wonder today if you have a patient, as you mentioned, some come in their 20s, but even 30s or 40s, is there ever a reason that they should consider an allo transplant as the best possible treatment if they have enough high risk factors? And what are those risk factors, or other reasons that they still want to really look at the allo as a good treatment option?
I think it's absolutely a correct option as long as the pros and cons of the approach are discussed in detail. Fact is that I would say irrespective of risk category, in a young patient, it is a conversation that most people, most physicians, myeloma physicians do have. Some are more active proponents of the procedure. Others have more of a neutral stance and involve the patient more in the decision. And I think the patient is, in this scenario, having to shoulder a lot of the responsibility of the decision because it's not an easy decision. I must say that I referred to patients that had myeloma develop in their 20s, and I can unfortunately say that I've had patients in their 20s who underwent an allogeneic transplant and unfortunately didn't make it a couple of years even, whereas if we were to have not done an allo, it is quite likely that though they may not have been cured, they could have had 10-plus years of a healthy life. And, you know, if you had a crystal ball, you'd be able to make the right decision for a patient. But I think that we still continue to advocate for it in younger patients as long as they know what the possible downsides are. But you are living proof that it is a procedure that carries promise for individuals as well.
Thanks very much, Dr. Reich.
Thank you, Jack. Nick Van Dyke, your questions? Are you online?
I am here. Can you hear me?
You bet.
Excellent. Nice to speak with you again, Doctor. One of these times I got to win the draw and go earlier because my questions get plucked off by the time I come around. So I'd kind of like to maybe just sort of recap. You know, I as some folks may recall from previous calls, I went the tandem auto route down in Arkansas, and I had always kept in the back of my mind, well, if God forbid it's wrong and I've got to have to deal with this again one day, there's always allo out there which has a curative potential, and I had not really kept up with it other than to note that treatment-related mortality has gone down. But it sounds as though there's a, you know, a pretty clear link between graft versus tumor and graft versus host. When one has improved the treatment-related mortality, it's potentially been at the expense of the overall curative potential of the treatment itself. So I guess one question would be, is that correct? Another a related question would be, we look a lot at drug development in the auto world, but we don't hear that much about specific studies done to, you know, improve the efficacy of allos as much. So I'm wondering what sort of things on the horizon there might be that could be an inflection point either for better graft versus host control or better graft versus tumor effect.
So, yep, you certainly made an apt observation that graft versus host disease and graft versus tumor control do go hand in hand for most part. The holy grail of transplant biology is for the person to somehow de-link graft versus host disease from graft versus tumor response, to be able to either pharmacologically or by manipulating the graft impact favorably graft versus host disease and maintain a graft versus tumor response. And the person who's able to definitively demonstrate that, I could say, is guaranteed the Nobel Prize in medicine. But the thing is that having said that, I think that it is very difficult at this time with the data to really say that our improvements in outcomes with reduced intensity transplant have come at the expense of a greater disease relapse. I think the data is not long enough to make that kind of observation. Plus, as I said, the reduced intensity transplant is usually used in conjunction with an autologous transplant up front. So you're trying to do both and thereby somehow reduce the mortality but preserve the beneficial effects. And I think that hopefully the data will show that we haven't reduced the we haven't increased the rates of disease relapse, but I think the data remains to be generated with long-term follow-up. As to your question about what advances are being made, so certainly we are well aware of the advances in pharmacological treatment of myeloma. I think that equally great strides are being made in transplant biology. I think That's an area where actually tremendous advances have been made over the last 15 years. Just as I said, with the use of reduced intensity transplantation, which offers this technology to a greater number of individuals into their 60s, late 60s, 70s, which was not feasible with full intensity transplantation. Secondly, the use of alternative donor sources is a really big area of research in allogeneic transplantation. In the past, we didn't have donors for everybody, and we certainly got better at using unrelated donors, and our results of unrelated donor transplantation now in nearly every disease approach a sibling transplant. As long as you get a fully matched unrelated donor, it doesn't matter whether you're doing it from a sibling or an unrelated individual. So that's been another major advance. Using alternative donors, we now can do, as we said, cord blood transplants, which are still transplants that are being done on investigational protocols, but more so recently, haploidentical transplants, which means you just need to be half matched to your donor. And with that, literally every person on earth would have a donor because you are half matched to either your children or your parents or your brothers or sisters. So most people would either have a parent, a brother, sister, or a child alive. And with that, now, intriguing data. I wouldn't say that this is something that is absolutely mature data, but intriguing early data suggests that we're starting to see, figures of survival that approach unrelated donor match transplantation. So we've certainly made, and this is by juggling the graft versus host disease preventative regimens that we use. We have better, more drugs to treat infections. So I think that we are making advances in allogeneic transplantation as well.
Great. Thank you very much.
And, Nick, we'll have you first next time.
No worries.
All right. And do you have any other? Do you have another question, Nick? Or
yeah, plenty more, but I think we should maybe
wrap up,
and then some our friends at the MMRC.
Okay. Well, thank you, Priya. If you could bring on some of the callers for allo questions, and what we'd like to do right now is to put a priority on the allo questions. So we'll have other. Of these broadcasts to answer the non-related auto questions. So if people could call in now, hit a 1 on your phone. If you hit 1 on your phone, you'll be put in the queue, and then Priya will bring you online. So please do that. Priya?
Yes, thank you, Gary. We'll be taking questions. If you have a question for our panel, please press 1 on your keypads and it'll bring you live. Yeah, we have a question. I think, Gary, you can start with the submitted questions. As and when people press 1, I shall bring them live on air into nature.
Okay, I'll do that.
Yeah.
The first question I have is from Pam, and Pam asks, for what I hear, it is only possible to have 2 allo transplants. Is this true? Have you ever heard of a person having 3?
So the thing is that certainly quite a few people undergo 2 allogeneic transplantations because of disease relapse or failure of engraftment. As far as 3 goes, yes. Have I had patients who had 3 transplants? Yes, but not for myeloma. Those are mainly for patients who've had acute leukemia. Usually these are individuals that are very young and underwent 2 transplants possibly early on and then had a very long period and then relapsed years later. They were in good health and then underwent a 3rd. But 3rd transplants are certainly much less common than 2.
Okay. And Joanne asked, I've had an autologous transplant 6 years ago. Currently take Revlimid as maintenance. I've been on it for 3 years this past May. My doctor is watching my light chains and proteins. I don't have a sibling match. Is an allo allogenic transplant even an option for me?
So I think I kind of answered that question, that you don't necessarily now need to have a sibling to undergo an allo. Now, it is a different question if that is the right decision because of the number of other alternatives that we have with newer drugs. But if one has to undergo an allo transplant, now, as I said, reuse of cord blood unrelated donor transplant, Caucasians have 80% chance of finding a fully matched unrelated donor. Minorities now, too, can literally all have a donor with a haploidentical transplant, and these are certainly technologies that have improved tremendously.
Okay, thank you. It's Masood. Masood, what are the requirements for a myeloma patient to be eligible for an allo transplant? My wife's brother is a perfect match, 10 of 10. Is she eligible for an allo transplant with below treatment history? And the treatment history is my wife is 49 years young and has been fighting myeloma for almost 8 years now. She has had all existing therapies, which includes thalidomide, Revlimid, Velcade, Dex, auto transplant, 18 months of PR. A combination of novel agents like Cytoxan, Doxil, Carfilzomib. Currently, she is on pololidomide, Velcade, and Dex. Her kidney is in excellent shape. She has had 4 vertebrae fractures, which were operated on and fixed.
So, again, I'll just give a general answer to the question. I think it's not appropriate for me to delve into individual histories and individual answers specific to patients without knowing the very, intricate details and not having seen a patient. All I can say is that we certainly do consider allogeneic transplants in young patients who have failed multiple therapies. It is, however, a procedure that we use very rarely. Chiefly driven by the fact that we've made progress and we continue to make progress with newer drugs in clinical trials like daratumumab, potentially being very effective. But yes, if everything else has failed, patient is in good health, then we will consider an allogeneic transplant in selected patients.
Okay. Also, Jason had asked, are allotransplants for myeloma more risky than allotransplants for leukemia and lymphoma? And if so, why?
So I think I partly addressed that in my initial monologue, that older data from the era of myeloablative transplant showed a high mortality of 30 to 50% at 6 months. And that is in excess of what you would see for allotransplants done for other indications. And why that is the case is still unclear. As I said at the beginning, it is potentially due to the comorbidities in patients with myeloma, the fact that they are often older individuals, and also the fact that they may have subclinical kidney involvement and other organ function involvement that may compromise their ability to get drugs.
Okay. Do you need, David asked, do you need to be in complete remission to do a full allo as part of a first-line therapy?
When we say full allo, I presume you're saying a fully myeloablative allogeneic transplant. For being in a complete remission improves the odds of the transplant being potentially curative. However, no, you don't need to be in a complete remission to be potentially cured. Even patients who have had, a partial response or less may benefit from an allogeneic transplant. We do, however, need to realize that if you are progressing on therapy prior to an allogeneic transplant, the chances of an allogeneic transplant helping are very slim.
Okay. Gregory asks, what is the significance of T cell depletion relative to allo stem cell transplants?
Again, I think we partly discussed on that issue. The T cells are what are contributory to graft versus host disease, and also to graft versus tumor response. So people do on clinical trials practice T cell depletion as a strategy to reduce the upfront morbidity and mortality due to graft versus host disease, and add back the T cells often later to promote gradually the graft versus tumor response. So I think that it is still early to say whether that strategy is better or not, but I think in the context of a clinical trial, certainly is an appropriate strategy to pursue.
Okay. We have a newbie. Looks like S-H-R-I-Y-A. And she is asking a number of questions, really trying to decide on what treatment philosophy she could take. But I'll talk about the first question. What is the difference between multiple myeloma and multiple plasmacytoma, and what are the prominent indicators for diagnosing these two?
Sure. I think that what she's referring to is the fact that some patients have multiple areas of involvement, either of bone or even soft tissue, but when you do a bone marrow biopsy, you fail to demonstrate any increase in plasma cells, so it seems like their disease is localized to multiple spots in the body. For all practical purposes, when you have two or more areas of disease, it is thought to be pretty akin to having bone marrow positive multiple myeloma, and most people treat it similarly. Now, in a very rare instance, you may try to radiate two separate areas, but once it is beyond two areas, it is very unlikely that localized treatment directed at those multiple plasmacytomas will quell the disease.
Okay, doctor, you've answered pretty much most of the questions, and if we don't have anybody calling in yet, what we'd like to do is go on to the next part of the presentation, and that is we'd like to bring online our special guest, Anne Quinn Young, and Anne Quinn is an MPH. And I used to think that meant miles per hour, but apparently it means Masters in Public Health. And she's the Vice President of Marketing at the MMRF, or the Multiple Myeloma Research Foundation, where she oversees all marketing and communications efforts, as well as educational programming. And she's got quite an extensive history, along with graduating cum laude from Dartmouth College, the Mailman School of Public Health. And I didn't know the Mailman had a school, but apparently they do, of public health at Dartmouth with a Bachelor's of Arts in Government. So we do certainly do appreciate all your efforts, Anne, and the MMRF, and we'd love to hear from you and have you tell us about all the wonderful activities that the MMRF has in the process. So if you could start with your presentation, that would be great.
Sure. And can you hear me okay?
Yeah, sure can.
Okay, perfect. Thank you, Gary. And just in case there are any other Columbia graduates on the call, it's the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia, not Dartmouth. So just want to make sure that the Mailman family gets their due. I just wanted to quickly say, Dr. Vige, as always, what a stellar job making sense of this intensely debated field. And then great questions, as always, from Pat, Jack, and Nick. It really is such an honor to be part of this call tonight. And I look forward to participating and listening into many of the others. So as many on the call probably know, the MMRF was founded 15 years ago in 1998 by twin sisters Kathy Juicy and Karen Andrews after Kathy was diagnosed with multiple myeloma when she was just 37 years old. And even though Dr. Vige said that there are patients, obviously, even more so in their 20s, 30s, 40s, it's still relatively rare to see patients being diagnosed that young. And at the time, she had a one-year-old, and she was a pharmaceutical executive. And, you know, as many folks who were diagnosed way back then, she was given just 3 years to live. As a pharmaceutical executive, she had the benefit to do a lot of research and to figure out what could be in the pipeline. And at the time, you know, this is 96, 97, there really was very little. There was little funding. Her grandfather had had the disease, and during her research, she discovered that basically, except for, high-dose chemotherapy and stem cell transplant, many of the treatments were the same as they'd been 30 years prior. So she started the MMRF with the simple goal to stimulate research, to put money into the research enterprise to accelerate the development of new treatments. And in 15 years, we've raised more than $225 million. Somehow, Gary, we need to make sure that your sources are updated, because you had mentioned 190. And, you know, thanks to the support of literally thousands and thousands of donors, we've raised over $225 million, which makes us the world's leading private funder of multiple myeloma-specific research. And we support a truly diverse research portfolio of programs ranging from basic science, translational research, into the clinic, and, of course, educational programs. And I would be remiss to not acknowledge all of our world-class partners, because it's these extraordinary collaborators that have really enabled the success of not only the organization but the entire community. Dr. Vige is one of them, not only a member of the MMRC, and as Gary mentioned earlier, past winner of MMRC Center of the Year for his incredible engagement and productivity, but also works closely with us on our COMPASS study, which I'll talk about in a minute. So, you know, kind of to recap the past, you know, what have we done with the $225 million? We've funded more than 350 grants at more than 130 centers worldwide. So you may hear a lot about the 16 centers that are part of the MMRC, but truly we have touched and funded centers not only in the U.S. and Canada and Europe, but Australia and Eastern Europe, and truly trying to make sure that we're funding the best research regardless of where it's being conducted. We've opened a central tissue bank through the MMRC that now has more than 3,700 samples, and some of those samples were then used in our genomics initiative, which ultimately led to the entire sequencing of the multiple myeloma genome for the first time. And the results of those 38 samples, we've since gone on to 250, were published in 2011 in Nature, and Dr. Vige was an author and a contributor to that effort as well. Through the MMRC specifically, we've opened 46 trials. That's 46 distinct clinical trials of 24 new agents. That doesn't include Velcade or Revlimid or thalidomide. And truly, our proudest moments came when Dr. Vige mentioned these earlier. In the past 13 months, the accelerated approvals of Kyprolis and Pomalyst, the MMRC, our centers, we worked side by side with Onyx and Celgene to make sure that these clinical trials were rapidly conducted to make sure that patients had access to these treatments as quickly as possible. Last year alone, we opened 7 new trials. Some of these exciting compounds include a trial involving the first oral proteasome inhibitor in myeloma, specifically exazimib from Millennium, and a trial that combined Pomalyst and Kyprolis together, and then some trials of agents with entirely new mechanisms of action. This year, we're on track to open probably 6 or 7 new trials. And again, some of these trials, we have about 10 to 12 trials going on at any one time. So there could be trials that opened a year or two ago that are still enrolling patients. One of the trial that we've opened this year that we're really excited about is a compound called SAR-650984. And that's similar to daratumumab that Dr. Vige mentioned earlier. It's an antibody targeting the CD38 antigen. And at ASCO, the American Society of Clinical Oncology meeting this past June, there was incredibly exciting data on daratumumab, again, a similar antibody, showing responses in patients who were heavily refractory, who no longer responded to you know, an IMiD and a proteasome inhibitor. So this class of antibodies is tremendously exciting. And we really, the one thing to note, too, within the MMRC, we want to make sure that we have a diverse portfolio. And if that means having multiple agents in the same class, for a couple of years we had trials with Kyprolis, but also with another proteasome inhibitor called Merizumib, which is now in phase two. So we make sure that we're bringing forward the next generation of proven classes of drugs, the proteasome inhibitors and the IMiDs, while also looking at new classes of drugs that often work synergistically with them. So in phase three now, and some of these early studies had been conducted through the MMRC, is an HDAC inhibitor called panobinostat. There's another antibody targeting a different antigen called elotuzumab that's in phase three, and that's also in different ongoing trials within the MMRC. So again, we make sure that we have that broad and diverse portfolio. What we're also proud of is that working with our centers, we have been able to make these clinical trials run more efficiently. We collect metrics on everything from the time it takes for a protocol to go through IRB and SRC review at a center until the time that we get all the signatures to the time that a first patient is actually enrolled. And what we've been able to show is that our trials open 60% faster than the standard in oncology. So, you know, again, we're incredibly proud of these achievements and a ton of are incredibly grateful to the many world-class partners that have been by our side as we've achieved this. But, you know, truthfully, it's not good enough. The disease is still not cured, as everyone on this phone knows. We know from our own genomics initiative and from others' efforts that multiple myeloma is incredibly heterogeneous. You know, many say it's not one disease, it's probably more like 10 diseases. And even within a single patient, you may have different types of myeloma cells. You may have multiple clones. So what our goal is to continue to leverage the latest technologies, the fact that whole genome sequencing is accessible now, to really start to understand what are the different types of myeloma. How can we characterize the disease in a way that we can better predict specific treatments that will work for specific populations of patients? And the cornerstone of that effort is the MMRF COMPASS study. We are working now with more than 60 different hospitals, research centers, including WashU. Dr. Veej and his team are one of our high enrollers into the trial, the USVA, US Oncology, and I'm announcing something a little prematurely, but you'll hear about it soon. We're bringing on centers in Spain and Italy as well to the COMPASS initiative. Really the goal is to follow 1,000 patients from diagnosis, collecting clinical data, collecting genomic data, putting it together, tracking how the disease changes over time for a single patient, but also taking these 1,000 patients and start to be able to possibly characterize them into different subgroups. What we also want to do is to make the data widely available. So we don't want to wait until it's possible to publish the data or have any other kind of holdup. We want to make sure that, you know, not only are the, you know, brilliant minds that we have pulled into COMPASS already are looking at the data, but also, you know, literally thousands of researchers worldwide. So coming from this study, and again, the MMRF is the sole sponsor, there can be no intellectual property. All inventions are dedicated to the public domain. And it's a credit to the centers that have signed on. And again, yet another kudos to Washington University in St. Louis, where Dr. Veej is based. They were the very first academic center to sign on. And I can tell you that as soon as one signed on, we had a whole slew of them to follow. So we are forever indebted to Dr. Veej and his team and the leadership at WashU for really taking that leap, because it allowed us to complete so much so quickly. We also have 4 industry partners supporting the initiative. Again, Millennium, Onyx, Janssen, and Bristol-Myers Squibb, all of whom have agreed that, again, they can't claim any IP to anything that comes out of Compass. I'm going to preempt a question. I saw a question from Jack saying, what is the status? As of about a week ago, we had 312 patients enrolled. We'd screened more than 500, and some of those, they weren't qualified because they had smoldering disease or they simply didn't have myeloma, so it was, a positive thing for them. But some of those smoldering patients, if their disease does convert over the course of the study, they would be included as well. We've also completed our third interim analysis, with the fourth one coming very shortly, whereby we have 178 patients worth of clinical data and 38 patients worth of genomic data. So I mentioned earlier that all of this data will go into the public domain, and we are in the process, or we've built, and are in the process in the next few weeks of taking the site live. It's the MMRF Researcher Gateway, when it's launched in September, again, all of the data from Compass, as well as from our genomics initiative, will be made available. And again, you'll all see this in a few weeks. The idea was not to limit the data to, bioinformatics specialists, but to make it accessible to, clinical folks who don't have that specific training as well, to give it an interface that's almost like an Amazon, where you can say, you know what, I'm interested in looking at patients who have a translocation of chromosomes 14, who, have been treated with this specific regimen. It will show you, what the results look like. Or, conversely, you can start from the clinical side to say, I'd like to see what patients who were treated with this specific regimen, those that did really well, that had complete responses, what did their genomic profile look like? And the idea is to have researchers who are looking at the data generate hypotheses that could be rapidly tested in clinical trials. So you could be looking at, this could be done within the MMRC, or, we're very open to, finding new partners, because if you're looking at trials that may be only suitable for 5, 10, 15% of patients, and those patients are widely dispersed, we need a mechanism to aggregate them quickly to make sure that these clinical trials run as smoothly and as efficiently as possible. One way that we're aiming to do this is we're also building a companion interface for patients called the MMRF Community Gateway. And on the MMRF Community Gateway, patients share information about their disease status, about their treatment history, about if they know their genomics, if they know specific translocations or deletions of particular chromosomes or genes. In that way, we'll be able to target specific clinical trials to them. So say a patient has been through a proteasome inhibitor and IMiD already, and is refractory to both, there are clinical trials available for those patients. We can say, hey, we have a clinical trial for you, and send them right there. If there's, in the past, there have been some treatments specifically for patients who have a translocation of 414. Again, if patients self-identify that way, we can let them know immediately about those clinical trial options. So the idea really is to generate high-quality data from the Compass study, to make it widely available through the MMRF Researcher Gateway, and then to begin to aggregate patients on those, according to those characteristics, within the Community Gateway, so that we can rapidly enroll clinical trials. And we're really excited about the potential for the Community Gateway for patients to really take a proactive role to, raise their hands to be part of the research process that could potentially not only accelerate more targeted therapies, but perhaps cures, cures for each specific subtype. So I want to put one last plug in for the Community Gateway to say that we're in beta testing now. So if anyone on the line is interested, and I know some of our panelists have already been involved, if you're interested in being part of the beta test, please, get in touch with me after this call, and I'd be happy to, in the next few days, send you a link to that. And So finally, beyond research, we also do support a number of educational programs. We have a patient support center that's staffed by oncology nurses, nurses that have experience in myeloma specifically. And that number is 866-603-6628. Again, it's 866-603-6628. So if you have questions after this call, feel free to give them a call. What they're really specialized in doing is helping patients get to the right clinical trials. We also have a website, but we try to tailor the information to where a patient is on his or her disease journey. So if you go to the section called Living with Multiple Myeloma, depending on whether you're newly diagnosed or further along in your disease, you can get information tailored specifically from you. And as a research foundation, we focus a lot of our educational programming and communication of efforts from major medical meetings. So we have webcasts every year from ASH and ASCO, and also have two or three teleconferences throughout the year. Just this past April, we did a live teleconference from the International Myeloma Workshop. And then we have print and monthly e-newsletters, very detailed brochures, and a clinical trials finder, which we love, and I'll put a plug in for TrialX, who's sponsoring this call, make it very easy for you to find clinical trials that you would qualify for and make it very easy for you to connect with the center that has those trials. So all of this is available on our website at mmrf.org. And I encourage all of you who haven't joined us to sign up today, and you can get information, you can get access to all this information, and be sure that you're receiving timely updates on progress and new data. And then finally, I take a few seconds to say that, we really are asking all patients to join the effort to accelerate new treatments in myeloma, whether it's enrolling in a clinical trial, whether it's contributing your tissue, whether it's sharing information on the community gateway, or, supporting our efforts by participating in one of our events or making a donation. As you would see on our website, we have events for everyone. We have very family-oriented 5K walk runs. We have endurance events. So, if someone either there are some patients who do these or family members who are interested in running a marathon or participating in a triathlon, we offer the opportunity to do that as well. We offer the opportunity to start your own fundraiser. So we, again, really encourage everyone to be part of this process. Do what you can. It allows us to support our world-class partners like Dr. Vision Washu. I do want to thank all of our supporters, all of our partners, for making our success possible. And, thank you again for the time on this call.
Thank you, Anne. I think that's all we have time for today. I thank the panel for being with us. Dr. Vish, thank you very much. And thank you very much. We thank all the supporters and our participants. Look forward to having all of you join us for our next live online myeloma support group meeting on August 28th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time with Pat Killingsworth. Please visit mmrfmyelomatrials.org to find myeloma clinical trials. For more details of our upcoming shows, please visit trialx.com/curetalk. The link for today's show will be sent via email to all participants. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Priya.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Anne, thank you.